This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with economists Rick Wolf and his son Max Wolf about the state of the recovery.
Recovery for some, but not for most. The country's economy and its jobs are falling apart. You'll hear why.
To commemorate the 95th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, we'll hear a segment from a special that aired this past week on WBAI. Stay with us. Michael, I've just learned that certain individuals, and this might exclude some of us in this room, who have been arrested but not convicted can't get jobs as census takers.
What's interesting, Heidi, is this could have been a big employment opportunity, particularly for blacks, Latinos, Native Americans, because the census is hiring a million or more people to assist with the 2010 census. But before you can get that job, they do a criminal check of sorts. And anybody whose record pops up with an arrest or conviction is automatically disqualified. And what they do is they send a letter to the person saying you have 30 days to correct this, but they don't say what the arrest or conviction was for. So the person is sitting there with 30 days and no way to even know what it is. And there's some 70 million people in the United States in this category, and a huge number of African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans. And what's also interesting about it is the system they use to check on these arrests and convictions is complete BS. It's vague, it doesn't work, it spits out all kinds of false information, and so that millions of people are being denied jobs, and particularly in a discriminatory way.
I smell a lawsuit here, Michael.
In fact, a few days ago, the Center for Constitutional Rights did file a class action lawsuit on behalf particularly of African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans who've clearly been discriminated against in this system. And what it reminds you of is, remember a few weeks ago, we did an interview with Michelle Alexander on her new book, The New Jim Crow. This is exactly what she talks about, how there's a disability through the criminal justice system that broadly affects particularly African Americans.
And especially with faulty record keeping, no transparency in the systems, and no way for individuals. I mean, I'm not sure if you've been arrested but not convicted, what is it that they want you to rectify?
No, I agree. It's extraordinary. If you figure there's 70 million as the Center lawsuit, or is 50 million more, as the New York Times editorial says, and if at least a third of those people have never been convicted of anything, it's a huge number that are getting turned down for census jobs that they probably really need. So it's a continuation of the system of discrimination in the whole criminal justice system. You get arrested and then you can't get work, and it just spirals on and on.
In studying the sort of theories of criminal justice, we always learn that the purpose of incarceration is to isolate from society, but also to rehabilitate. And clearly, our system is failing us there. Education systems aren't happening. And then the stigma of being institutionalized, you can't get a job like this. Where's the rehabilitation and reintegration into society?
And Michael, you have your hand up. I don't know why you put your hand up in the studio, but it's okay. It's a good idea.
Well, to echo the former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, rehabilitation is a quaint concept. That was a 19th century liberal concept. I think now people are put into prison to warehouse them, to control them and manage them, and they have no notion of rehabilitation. They don't even allow these people to lift weights anymore, let alone get college courses. They're just put in cages, and that's what the system is designed to do.
There's
now
No doubt about it. New York State, actually, a few years ago, wiped out any kind of educational system in their prisons for high school degrees or college degrees. The Pell Grants were turned down for all prisons across the country. And, of course, it's much cheaper to educate people and get them jobs when they get out than to keep warehousing them. And what that demonstrates, clearly, your point, Michael, what they want to do is warehouse certain parts of our population, and they, unfortunately and sadly, wind up to be African Americans and Latinos.
Bravo on the center's lawsuit. This is another great case that you're taking up.
I'm thrilled we're doing it, but it's very sad that we have to. And it goes right to what Michelle Alexander is saying, the incredible disabilities put on an entire population in this country.
Goldman Sachs is in the news. God bless them. The biggest contributors to the Obama campaign. U.S. News and World Report had an article about the revolving door. Goldman in high places. And they've got 10 of these gentlemen, all former or current officers of Goldman, and how they go in and out of government. Just to give you an idea, I'm going to talk about two of them. Henry Paulson at Goldman. He was the chairman and chief executive director. He was the Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush. Neil Kashkari at Goldman. He was the security investment banking guy, and he now ran the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, the TARP program. So he went from Goldman into the government to give money back to Goldman.
That sounds like a conflict of interest to me.
I have a poem to underlie that point, Heidi. It's a poem that was used actually for the title of Tony Judt's new book, Ill Fares the Land. Tony Judt, of course, is the wonderful historian at NYU who's been reflecting on his life and on the situation in so-called Democratic America because he has Lou Gehrig's disease and he's in very bad shape.
And he's still writing amazingly. I read his pieces every week now in New York Review of Books, and there's some fabulous stuff. Even though he's, you know, a social democrat, essentially, he's given up on anything to do with the hard left. But
he's really courageous and trying to sum up his thoughts even as he's dying. And he wrote this book, Ill Fares the Land, which is a poem taken from an Oliver Goldsmith book back in 1770. The whole book is called The Deserted Village. And here's two lines from the poem. Ill fares the land to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulates and men decay. They should put that as the slogan over the new Goldman Sachs building in my neighborhood.
Well, what do you think is going to come of these indictments?
What Heidi's referring to as indictments was actually a civil suit brought by the SEC to recover certain kinds of damages against a couple of Goldman guys. And it's a pretty interesting development as to what Goldman was doing. What they did is they took a number of mortgages, subprime mortgages, and they packaged them into securities. And then they sell those securities to investors. So you come along and you say, I'll buy some of those because I'll get a fairly high interest rate. This is before the crash. And the investors bought those, figuring Goldman's packaging them. They're going to be secure. I'll get my interest. Little did those investors know that on the other side of those transactions, there was a guy in cahoots with Goldman who actually constructed those portfolios of mortgages, and he constructed them apparently with some of the worst mortgages in the country so that they would be guaranteed to fail as mortgages. And then he bet, however you do this in Wall Street, he bet that those mortgage packages would fail. So here's Goldman in the middle selling securities to, let's say, Heidi and Michael saying, oh, these are going to be good mortgages. You're going to make 6%, 7%, 8%, 9%. And on the other side, they're in cahoots with a guy who's betting those packages will fail. Now, you can do in Wall Street, you can actually bet, sell mortgages on one side and bet against them on the other. But the real problem here when I read it to me, if you're thinking about it, is when they sold to those investors, they thought that Goldman had put those packages together with a great deal of care and fiduciary duty and that they were picked by Goldman to not fail. But in fact, they'd been picked in cahoots with this other guy, apparently, to fail. That sounds really bad.
It reminds me of the producers and the play Springtime for Hitler
That's right.
That they wanted to fail. But in all seriousness, let's hope that our attorney general does decide to bring criminal prosecutions, because this is nothing short of criminal.
Today, we welcome back Rick Wolf, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts, and his son, economist Max Wolf, freelance researcher, strategist, and writer in the areas of international finance and macroeconomics, to discuss the current economic recovery. That is it a recovery without jobs? Rick is also the author of the new book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. Rick, Max, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Is the wolf still at the door? That's the question.
Always.
Well, according to the New York Times, there's a bit of a recovery. There's room for hope. What's the story, guys?
Well, I don't think any of us would want to be in the business of telling people when it's a good time to hope and not. The last time we've seen that try didn't go so well. So I think that's probably outside of the realm of my – it's above my pay grade. But I will tell you that there's a recovery in some parts of the economy, not others. I like to think of it this way. I think we have a dumbbelled economy. So we have an area – we have some areas like the two edges of the dumbbell that are very strong where there's a real recovery. And it's in some cases amazing and more than I would have forecast. And then we have a kind of missing middle. And the middle of our economic puzzle should be job growth and the increase in the prices of the average house, because the average person in America lives off their wages and the value of their only asset, which is their home. And unfortunately, the labor markets continue to be extremely weak, and house values continue to be about 30 to 35% off their 2006 peaks.
Yeah, I think, you know, to drive the point home, we have had a continuous growth in unemployment. The unemployment number that was quoted everywhere in December of 2007 when this downturn began was 7 million people looking for work, unable to find it. Today, that number is 15.5 million people, and that number has almost continuously been going up. And so the result is, over the last 2 years or so, you'd see a situation in which, for the people affected by unemployment, this is no recovery in sight, and that shapes a great deal of what happens in our society. For example, it's not just the people who are looking for work but don't have it. If you actually add the people who have a part-time job but wish they had a full-time job, and you add in on top of it the people who are so-called discouraged workers who've been looking so long without success that they'd literally drop out and go back into their homes and so on, then we're talking officially, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, something on the order of 17%. That's one out of six Americans in the labor force are in a situation that is dire in terms of employment. And one out of six means every single family in America either has a member of that family or a neighbor or a relative in that situation, causing everyone to live with the consequences of what that means. In those terms, for those people, which is most of us, there's no recovery.
There's a concept not known to economists but known to Yiddish-speaking people around the world called Gornish Helfen. Nothing can help. Are we in that situation now? Is this going to be a permanent aspect of the American capitalist economy, that there's a huge number of unemployed?
Some people have referred to this as a quote-unquote jobless recovery. It's kind of lame admission by people who talk a lot about the recovery of what Max just said, which is that it's an uneven recovery, to say the least, because somebody has recovered, but you put that adjective jobless in front of it is an admission that there's a big unemployment problem. And I think you raise a very fundamental question to which the answer is unknown, whether these people will ever be reabsorbed into the labor market, whether we haven't, as a society, made implicitly a decision to outsource jobs to the rest of the world where wages are lower and conditions of profitability are better, whether we haven't automated our way out with the computer, whether we haven't basically come to a point in American society where there's an immense redundance, where the mass of the American working people are told basically, if you want a job, you're going to have to work at much lower pay than you used to get. And if you're not willing to do that, you're going to be unemployed for an indefinite period of time.
Rick, in your article, Phony Economic Recovery, Real Alternatives, you talk about alternative strategies that could yield a real recovery in job, namely direct government hiring. Can you explain that a bit?
Yes. The reason I raised that in the article was because I want readers to be aware that even in American history, even the president of a former president of the United States in the last Great Depression that we had 75 years ago in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt basically went on the radio one day in 1932 or 3, I think it was, and said something like this. This is not a quote, but to paraphrase him, that if the private sector cannot provide jobs for the American people, then there's nothing else to do but to have the government do so. Well, that's an interesting admission that he made. And then he then followed through. The two major programs were the Civilian Conservation Corps and the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. And eventually that provided 11 million jobs. That's an awful lot between 1933 and 1942. it was a way of putting people to work. They built highways. They built, some of you know, the Merritt Parkway that goes out of New York to Connecticut. That was built by public employees.
That could have made it a little wider, you know.
You know, but it's one of the most beautiful parkways in the world. Compare that to going up on 95, right, for example. It's a really beautiful piece of work.
And there's no trucks on it because it's a parkway. We like that. No tolls.
Right. And they built national parks. The WPA is famous for employing all the unemployed artists in America and sending cultural teams of painters and actors and dancers to parts of the United States that had never had such cultural programs before and have never had them since. So here was a program that, as I say, created 11 million jobs. By modern standards, if you just updated it with our population, that would be a major attack on unemployment in this country. And just think for a minute, if the government did that, we could begin to utilize the one-third of our industrial capacity that is now idle. That's a government figure. We could put these people to work using that capacity. There would be all kinds of outputs that are socially useful. These people would be paid a salary, which would mean they could make their mortgage payments and not lose their homes. They would buy stuff, which would keep people working in places that produce goods and services, et cetera, et cetera. So you kind of have to wonder that we live in a time when we have massive unemployment. The recovery, as Max has pointed out, didn't deal with that problem. And yet we do not have a national discussion, even of something that has already been done in American history, which is direct employment.
Contrast that, Max Wolf, to the huge government bailout with billions of our tax dollars to the banks with no transparency, no strings attached, as far as I can tell, with no success in alleviating the unemployment situation.
I should just point out that I think both our guests here, both Max and Rick, supported the bailout. Is that right?
I most definitely supported the bailout.
And I think Rick did as well.
No, I definitely did support the bailout, and I still do, because I think that having a banking system wasn't optional. I didn't think it was optional then. I don't think it's optional now. I think the bailout has been a giant distraction, too. On the bailout, the banks either already all have or will pay back the federal government in full with an approximate profit of $14 billion. And we did need a banking bailout. I think what's important about it, and I think speaks to Michael's point, is we chose to bail out some elements of the society and not others. $700 billion for a financial system that's been, I think it's fair to say, less than socially useful was a decision we were all willing to make. And a couple of $100 billion to make sure that, say, kids can continue to go to school on the subway, or community colleges can stay open, or that job training programs can stay open, or that the state of California can stay open, we decided was a waste of money. So I think our bigger problem is about the lack of strings attached to the bailouts. I think we copied other countries' bailout programs. You can see it in the Cash for Clunkers auto system too. We copied other countries' bailouts and we dropped all the socially valuable parts. So we said, we'll bail you out, but fire at will. Can your unionized workers if you want. You don't have to make any loans in the future. You can keep your same management. You can keep the same business operations you had before. That part I don't think was a terribly genius idea. But I do think that the keeping a financial sector is unfortunately very important to the United States. And part of the sort of we don't need the banks, screw them that we got, and I understand the sentiment is well deserved from the help we got from our large banks, is a part of the country's denial. This is a country where the average person has a 30-day life expectancy without international finance because they buy everything at the grocery store with a credit card with a balance. If that gets turned off 60 days after failure to pay, they can't brush their teeth or wipe their behinds or get carrots and broccoli. They don't own their house. They don't own their car, right? The average American now owns 35% of their house. And that's not really true because a third of people owe nothing on their house. Right, so they've paid it off full and clear. If you look at people with mortgages, the average person with a mortgage in America owns about 16% of the value of their home. So this idea we don't need the bank is tantamount now to saying I don't need food, shelter, and transport. So we do need the banking system. We just need a banking system that's a little bit less predatory and a little bit more socially devoted. So I do think that the bailout was probably excessive. There weren't enough strings attached. But I do think we needed to have other long-term social plans. And I think our failure to plan an industrial strategy in the United States has become a plan to fail. And it's sad that we didn't re-examine it and take a different path in the wake of a really kind of jarring, high-voltage electric shock about the mistakes of our past, which we got between the early portion of 2008 and the early portion of 2009.
The bailout of the General Motors Corporation in the United States is what Max is referring to, having allowed them then to lay off huge numbers of people, to end whole lines of production,
61,000 UAW members. Right,
to devastate the city of Detroit, which was already devastated. The irony is, at the same time, the German government was negotiating to bail out a subsidiary of General Motors called the Opel Corporation in Germany. And they made a deal, and they helped them on condition that nobody would be fired. That was accepted by the same General Motors Corporation for a bailout in Germany and was not even broached as an obligation of the General Motors Corporation here. That's
a very telling example. Yeah, that's amazing.
Talk about why. What is the difference in terms of the relationship of class forces in Germany as to America?
Well, to give you an example, in Germany you have a much stronger trade union movement that is entrenched in all the metal production industries of the country, particularly auto. That trade union is closely associated with two of the major political parties who together have probably 30 to 40% of the vote. That is the Social Democratic Party of Germany and the new left party, Die Linke Party. Between those two parties and the massive amount of votes that they have, and remember, in Germany you have parliamentary proportional representation. So if you get 30% of the vote in the national election, you have 30% of the deputies in the parliament. It's not like here. You put all that together, and you have a history in which politics in that society is governed and shaped by the interests of workers in unions and in left political parties. Nothing comparable to that exists in the United States. So the kinds of deals that have to be worked out, not just the one that I mentioned with the bailout, but in hundreds of smaller cases, have to tilt to meet the demands of masses of working people that you don't have in this society. And the result is the difference between what General Motors could get from the American government versus what it could negotiate from a conservative government, by the way, in Germany. Merkel is a conservative. Obama is left of that, one would think, but it's the forces in the underlying society that shape the outcome.
We could add, too, on our cash for clunkers, that part of this was supposed to be environmental, and we use some of our scant environmental budget in the United States for our cash for clunkers. The Europeans recycled the auto parts and the cars they bought out, right? And they made sure that only to get the tax credit, the new car had to actually have very good fuel standards. We gutted that to allow new SUVs and trucks, and then we took the old cars, put silica in the engine, and ran them till they seized and dropped them in the landfill to prevent pushing down the price in the used car parts market. However, pushing down the price in the used car market would have also made it cheaper to maintain your car, which is ultimately better for the environment, for low-income people who, even with the government grant, couldn't afford a new car. So we said, if you can't afford a new car, you get nothing. And if you're interested in the planet and the planet's perilous future, you get nothing in our cash for clunker plan. So we really hit the ball out of the park here. And we had a plan to copy. Since we were copying someone else's plan, it's rather remarkable that we found a way to spend more and get less.
Let me ask, I didn't understand that completely, but had we not destroyed the engines by putting them in the landfill, filling them with silica.
They ran them till they literally seized.
Right. What would have then happened is you would have had lower used prices for cars on the market.
You would have artificially flooded the market for a period of time with vehicle parts for the old cars being traded in, and it would have depressed the used car parts market, which would have caused some pain and some damage, but it would have made it a lot cheaper for anybody out there getting a used part to fix up a car.
Gotcha.
And this is valuable on two reasons. One is lower income people are probably going to have to fix their existing cars because they can't go out and afford a new one. So it's a subsidy to the poor, which was not a bad idea when we're minting so many new poor people anyway. And the other thing is that it's environmentally at least debatable whether any new car is better than running an existing car further, because all the ecological damage associated with producing the tires and shipping the car around the world and the car's production is already sunk cost environmentally when the car is already out there on the road. So in many cases, running it longer, even though it sounds bad, is ecologically preferable to getting the newer car, which then has to be made and use new natural resources and be moved all over the world, etc.
If I could add just one thing on this recovery that we haven't mentioned. We've talked about the unemployment. We've made some mention of the housing market collapse. Another area that deserves at least as much attention is the fact that when the income is dropped because people are unemployed, and when houses go down in price and people are foreclosed, the flow of revenue income tax, property tax into the cities and states of the United States drops. That has been catastrophic over the last year and a half, causing almost every state in the United States and almost every municipality to face the horrible dilemma with a cut in revenues because of the decline in the economy. They either have to find new taxes to make up for what's not coming in, or they have to cut social spending on all the things that cities and states are supposed to do. That is savaging, for example, New York. It's savaging California. It is causing across the nation vast amounts of pain. Schools are being cut because they're often discretionary outlays. The effects of that will be to damage the education of Americans for years to come, with social consequences that are incalculable. And in most states, it is leading the government, because it's afraid to tax the rich because they have the political muscle to fight back, the poor because they can't anymore. So they're choosing to cut services. There is one exception which is worth people knowing. In the state of Oregon, last summer in Oregon, the legislature, controlled completely by the Democratic Party, passed a bill which said, we're going to face our $700 million shortfall in the state of Oregon, not by cutting any social program. They specifically cited California next door. We're not going to do that. We're going to tax corporations and the rich. I didn't make this up. The legislature passed the bill. The governor signed the bill. It became law last summer in Oregon. The conservatives, the business community, and the Republican Party went crazy, as you might imagine, and utilized the law of referendum in Oregon to force a referendum, which in those states you can do. The referendum was set, I believe, the end of January or beginning February of this year. 1.2 million citizens in Oregon went to the polls and overwhelmingly endorsed the law. It is the law in Oregon, and they raised the tax on corporations, they raised the tax on everybody who makes $250,000 a year or more, and they raised even higher the tax of those who make $500,000 a year or more, and that's how they've solved it. So for people who think it couldn't go other than the way it is, here's a concrete example here in the United States where a concerted effort, unions, liberal folks, and the Democratic Party, which is left of the where it is in the rest of the country, in Oregon, were able to prevail and to get the support of a clear majority of the people.
Given that that is an exception, can you give us sort of a forecast of what is going to happen in terms of a real recovery in the next few years?
Well, I mean, I do think we're going to see pretty good hiring numbers for a couple of months. I think that they'll be less good than the general impression. So people have a tendency to forget that we need 110 to 120,000 new jobs net every single month just to keep up with population growth. So any month that we have less than 115,000 new jobs, we're actually having a declining percentage of our population employed. People have a kind of a tendency to forget this. Do I think that the unemployment level will be high for a while? Yes. The trend we started seeing in the March numbers is a little bit disturbing. Across the month of March, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average American made less than they did the previous month. So we had some net hiring, right? And I think we're going to keep getting net hiring. But I think people have a tendency to imagine something which makes intuitive sense but turns out to be wrong, which is when you lose jobs and then you gain jobs, it's not the same people getting hired back at the same jobs. The jobs you lost kind of tend to stay lost, and the new jobs tend to be kind of new jobs. And if those new jobs offer stingier benefits packages and or lower salaries, then that depresses the more or less the overall earnings stream for the average American. And I think that's a big deal. I think the way that we pulled off a quote-unquote jobless recovery from 2002 to 2007 was an explosive parabolic growth in consumer debt. So we could have an overall economic recovery, people buying more things, without people getting more and better jobs, which is kind of perplexing. And the way we did it is by borrowing. The problem is we're all borrowed out, so we literally can't jump in that lake twice. We kind of put the straw in there and drank it all down. So I don't think we're going to get the same kind of jobless recovery twice. I do think we'll see at least two or three more quarters or three-month periods of positive GDP growth, although by late in the third, beginning of the fourth quarter of 2010, I think I'd start to get a little bit nervous. And I think it's going to continue to be a very mixed recovery with some people cashing in and some people not. Probably the best way for me to answer that, though, is I think when the dust settles and the historical data is out, and it is not yet, that we will see that the last 18 months probably witnessed the largest upward redistribution of wealth in modern American history, possibly ever in the country. Because the average
bigger
person—
Bigger than what we have in the last number of years? We're already—
Yeah, much bigger.
We already became the most disequal country of any capitalist country.
Yeah, but I think it'll be much much bigger, because what happened last 25, 30 years in a lot of ways was the bottom 80% stood still and the top 20%, led by the top 5%, shot up. And the last 7 or 8 years, we saw the lower income folks kind of stand still, tread water, and the top shoot up. So you're absolutely right. We saw a sort of yawning gap there. But I think what's happened in the last 18 months is sort of unprecedented. We saw one of the largest periods of unemployment. We saw stagnant to falling wages. And we saw the only asset that middle class America has, their house, lose 30% of its value. This has almost never happened before. And we saw at the same time financial assets plunge and then very robustly recover. So if you benchmark to 1 year ago, 1 year ago, the average financial asset in the country was worth 70% less than it is today. So we've seen a real rally in the value of financial assets held. About 90% of our financial assets are held by the top 20% of the country. The rest of the country relies on the value of their house and their job. Their job is flat to no growth wages with possible unemployment bouts of extended period. And their basic asset, their home, lost 30% of its value. And I think that we also saw gateways to the middle class get reduced with soaring college tuitions and inabilities to stay in college by low-income people and cutting state services and a major attack on both industrial employment and basic municipal, state, federal, and county employment, which is just beginning now. So I think when the dust all settles, we might have been looking at, if not the worst, one of the worst 18-month periods for wealth inequality growth in the entire recorded, and we only kept data since the 1930s, but in the recorded data period of American history. That would be my personal guess.
And I think you can see the effects. If you have 30 years during which the mass stays flat because wages go nowhere, whereas the top experiences explosive growth, like Michael said, and then you follow it, as Max says, with 2 years in which the one asset that anybody in the working class accumulates in his or her life, the house, drop by a third, you have given a 1-2 punch to the mass of people that may begin to explain to folks why there are teabaggers, why there are very angry people who look at their job possibilities, their home situation, their financial possibilities for their children, and the American dream, which they had thought they were entitled to, has just moved way out of reach. No one has explained it to them, and they're looking around for the scapegoat that did it to them. And we know where that can go, because we have plenty of examples in history where the collapse of a middle, short-term or long-term, and we have both here now, has disastrous social consequences.
Economists Max Wolf and Rick Wolf, do you have any final thoughts for our audience?
I mean, I think one thing that's interesting is that for a long period of American history, at least 60 or 70 years, the two basic gateways that you built into the middle class or the upper middle class were to get a college degree and to get a house. And the college degree gave you more job security and kind of more or less higher earnings profile across your life, helped your kids. And the house was a forced savings plan, which even if it didn't appreciate your house that much, it forced you to save and it gave you inheritable wealth to transfer to the next generation. That college degree, that owned home, which you can then in some portion or in whole give to your children, was the kind of citadel of middle classdom in the country. And we've seen something weird happen in the last 20 years, kind of coming to a top-out crescendo in the last 2 or 3 years. And we've seen the college experience, become one that saddles people with a lot of debt and pushes them into a fairly weak job market.
I would only comment that two small points. One, on the school, college education. The leading Ivy Leagues schools 2 or 3 weeks ago announced their prices for the next academic year, September 10 to May 2011. The tuition, room, and board at Harvard, Yale, and those kinds of places will be $51,000 a year. That, by the way, that's called a year, but it actually runs from September to April. So it's two-thirds of a year. One-third isn't covered. They estimate at least another $9,000 for computers, books, travel, and the usual other expenses. That's $60,000 a year per year. So to send your kid through a reasonably good college in the United States at that price would cost you $250,000, and you'd get a BA, which in today's market doesn't really get you very much. So what in the world are we doing when we have millions and tens of millions of people unemployed, and it costs $250,000 to put your child through a college education? And I understand other schools are cheaper, but they're always leading the way and everybody else follows suit. So you have an extraordinary inequality being built into our system. The other thing is, I would like to go back and talk about the scapegoat problem. a society coming under the kinds of pressures we've been talking about today, for all the reasons that Max and our discussion shows, is a society increasingly strained and looking for somebody to blame. And one of the examples we have today is, I'm going to pick someone that everyone loves to hate these days, the Goldman Sachs Corporation, right? They did all kinds of things one has every right to question and be doubtful about. But to pick a particular company or a particular industry and to find them the ones that did the bad thing is extremely dangerous for a simple reason. Everybody in this game over the last 30 years in this country has played by the way this game works. The corporations did what they do to make money. The workers did what they do to try to hold on to the quality of their life. That's why they borrowed money, and that's why the corporations lent it to them, because that's the way this game is played. To solve the problem of this society means to question and change the system, not to go find a particular player in it and beat up on him or her. That's not only unfair to them, it's a mistake in terms of solving the problem. It means you'll change the leadership at Corporation X. That's not going to change the way Corporation X works. Change the people who run this or that. Change a little bit of the rules here or there. They get around those rules. They change the rules later when no one's looking. You're not going to deal with this if you don't deal with the underlying structure of this system. And that's what people seem to be afraid to face.
Well, what kind of system would you want, Rick?
Well, that's a whole nother program.
Another
Maybe
program.
We ought to organize.
We'll have you back on, and okay, we'll have that program. That'd be a good discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
This past April 24th marked the 95th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. To honor the memory of the over 1.5 million Armenians who were intentionally and systematically killed, I interviewed several first-generation survivors in New Britain, Connecticut, for a special program that aired on WBAI. The Armenian Genocide Special was produced under the auspices of WBAI Public Affairs Director Kathy Davis, along with Program Director Tony Bates and Station Manager Muriel Tillinghast. We go now to listen to a segment from that special. Around the world, April 24th marks the observance of the Armenian Genocide. On that day in 1915, the Interior Minister of the Ottoman Empire ordered the arrest and hangings of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople. The date is widely considered to be the original beginning of a systematic and well-documented plan to eliminate the Armenians, who had been under Ottoman rule and treated as second-class citizens since the 15th century. The unspeakable and gruesome nature of the killings, beheadings of groups of babies, dismemberments, mass burnings, mass drownings, use of toxic gas, lethal injections, render oral histories particularly difficult. Why did this happen? Despite being deemed inferior to Turkish Muslims, the Armenian community had attained a prestigious position in the Ottoman Empire, and the central authorities there grew apprehensive of their power and their longing for a homeland.
A concerted plan of deportation and extermination was allowed to be carried out, in large part, because World War I demanded the involvement and concern of potential Allied countries. As the writer Grigoris Balakian wrote, the war provided the Turkish government, quote, their sole opportunity, one unprecedented, to exploit the chaos of war in order to effect their extermination plan. As Armenians escaped to several countries, including the United States, a number came to New Britain, Connecticut in 1892 to work in the factories of what was then known as the hardware capital of the world. By 1940, nearly 3,000 Armenians lived there in a tight-knit community.
"95 years has gone by, and they still have not acknowledged that this happened, and it was a genocide.
As a nation, how can they deny this? I mean, how can it be denied? It's a half of a population was removed."
"I don't like Turks per se because of what they did to our people, but I do enjoy the culture.
Why would I grow up hating the Turks if she didn't tell us stories? Well, then we must have been told something that we hated the Turks."
Armenians had a lot of power, a lot of control. They were the merchants. They were people who, in essence, were major drivers of the economy and the world in Turkey.
"Yeah, I think they were threatened by the culture. And the genocide started in 1915, April 24, in Istanbul, where they took all the intelligentsia of the country and took them outside of the city and hanged them."
The overlay was, of course, religious, with Muslims, and they're the first country to acknowledge Christianity as a national religion. So, you know, there's a lot of history here with all of that.
"The other thing that the Turks used to say, where is your Jesus now? Where is he? Why isn't he saving you?" Well, they would say
funny,
this on the death marches.
My brother Ernest was killed in an automobile accident. And his uncle came over to my house and said, "Hey, Ostian, where is your God now?" And she cupped her ears and she said, "Chilasim, chilasim, I don't want to hear that. God gave him to me and God took him away." How much more Christian could you be?
As you will hear from the stories of first-generation Armenian survivors who continue to live in New Britain, Connecticut, a shared history, a shared identity emerges. Some learned about the massacres directly from their parents or family members, while others were not told at all. Often, surviving women were ashamed to talk about what they had experienced, because so many of them had been raped or forced into harems. For others, conjuring up visual images of the atrocities was too painful to bear. When parents did speak about the crimes they experienced or witnessed, they frequently spoke in Turkish or Assyrian instead of English or Armenian, so that their children couldn't understand. Most children of survivors say that the subject was a secret, even forbidden.
"My mother did not keep secrets from us. She spoke about the Turks. She hated the Turks. She made us hate the Turks. I remember as a teenager, I wanted to send away for Turhan Bey's picture in Hollywood, and he was a very handsome Turkish actor. We weren't allowed anyway. But the ones who did keep it secret were the ones who were ashamed of what happened. And I know for a fact many of the older women, older than my mother, had gotten raped. Those are the ones, in my opinion, in this area, were the ones who kept it secret."
"I grew up hearing, like the others, my mother didn't talk about it to me, ever. But I was a little girl, and my mother was quite a bit older than I was. She was older when I was born. And so her friends would come over, and they would sit and talk to each other. The next thing you know, they'd all start crying. And I would cry, too. And my mother would turn to me and say, 'Why are you crying?' And I'd say, 'Because you're crying,' and not knowing why I was crying."
Harry Mazadorian is a lawyer and a national authority in alternative dispute resolution.
I grew up in New Britain, Connecticut, where we had a good-sized Armenian population. Both my parents were genocide survivors, both from the province of Harput or Kharpert, and nearby villages. One was the village of Ichman, one was the village of Yereki. We have a number of people in New Britain from both those villages. My parents did not know each other in the old country, met here. They had a very different path to the United States. They came, my mother survived and was in an orphanage, did not know that her father, who had come to this country to earn a fortune for the family, where he was, and he did not know she had survived. He found her sometime later in her teens and brought her here. My father's father was an American citizen. He had come here twice. I can't remember the dates, but first time about the Spanish-American War, after the first Armenian massacre started around 1896. Came to the United States. We tracked down where he was, went back, came here once more, and then went back again with very bad timing. He was taken away and killed when my father was about 9. Some of the stories are, we talk about what we heard and what we, which parents were more willing to speak. I'd heard some stories from my folks, and one particularly from my father, that I respectfully listened to, but I didn't really think it could happen. One of the three young Turks who led the assault on the Armenians was Enver Pasha. And the story my father tells was that in about 1916, a year after the genocide began, Enver Pasha came to Ichmeh. And I'm thinking, well, why would Enver Pasha go to Ichmeh? My grandmother had some documents which demonstrated that my grandfather was an American citizen. And she bribed her way into the dinner where Enver Pasha was meeting with some big shots, and said to Enver Pasha, when she got in, "I'm the wife of an American citizen." Something about, I'd like safe passage. Well, he was all smiles, Enver Pasha, and said, "Oh, come closer, come closer, you're an American." And then he turned, almost pathologically, he turned and said, "This woman's an American, why is she still alive?" And kicked him out. A few years ago, I'm reading the notes, the comments, the memoirs of Leslie Davis, United States Consul to Harper. And he tells of two meetings with Enver Pasha. Same time. Could this be? You know, I read on, and Enver Pasha says to him, as he documents in his memoirs, now this is the U.S. Consul, "Tell me, Mr. Davis, how do you spend your time?" "Oh, I go horseback riding." "Ah, tell me about your horseback riding." And Leslie Davis tells him. And again, Enver Pasha is this congenial guy, welcoming comments. And then he turns, again in this pathological way. He says, "And when you go riding, do you send your letters to the Americans telling them what's going on in Turkey?" Leslie Davis knew that many of his messages had been intercepted by the Turks, but he didn't know that he'd been watched by Enver Pasha. So here are these two different people, my grandmother and Leslie Davis, talking to this madman who welcomes them with his, you know, glowing comments, "Tell me more about yourself," and then turns in a rage and dismisses them. I'm thinking, wow, this story was true. The stories that we heard are, you know, pretty similar. Barbaric, consistent. As lawyers, we look for consistency in determining the trustworthiness of stories we hear. And the consistency in these stories is just remarkable. My mother's story is a little different. She was actually in the death march, but she was given away by her mother. It's a little hard for me to talk about. She lived with Arabs and then went to an orphanage, remarkably survived the genocide, survived the collapse of the orphanage in Yereki. The building just fell down around her. And then they were all going to Greece, and the boat almost sank. And I think Ruth Swisher's mother was on the same boat. When they got to Greece, they found that the folks there had already held a requiem service for her. They weren't dead, but they made it. They all ended up with safe passage to this country, but they went through some very, very grueling times. And if there's one theme that comes throughout all this, it's just barbarism. Now, you know, the story that's told the current Turkish government, and some of it was told by the Ottoman government, was that it was not a genocide. It was a deportation, that the citizens who were being deported were well cared for. And if any of this happened, it was those Kurds. I mean, we wouldn't do that. Turks wouldn't do that, but you never know what those Kurds are going to do. But as the stories unfold from all of the survivors, there were the Turkish military and the police and the brigands and those who were released from prisons who just came upon the Armenians, and this terrible fate befell them. You know, both my parents remember the last time they saw their parents.
My name is Agnes Barsoyan Karanian, and I was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hustian was my mother. Her name was Hustian Hayotsian. She married at a very young age, which was customary at her time, to Mirjan Yerian. She had her first child, Yerishe, Ernest, at age 17. Soon after that, she had two more sons named Hagop and Barkev. She also had three daughters named Hrepsimeh, Asnif, and when Asnif died, she named another daughter Asnif because she loved that name. Another child was born en route when the family was being deported from their hometown of Zaras, Sivas. Mirjan insisted they give the baby to a Turk or a Kurd, but she refused, saying, "This baby was born a Christian and will die a Christian." And she wrapped the baby up and put it under a tree. And I was 12 years old, and I would be crying. "How could you do that?" And she said, "Archigas, I couldn't take care of the older children, let alone take care of the baby." She was very religious. She was very, you know, a real good Christian.
I loved being in Istanbul. I really did. Absolutely. It's what we're used to. If you haven't been there, you don't know what we're talking about. We sat down to a meal. I thought my mother was in the kitchen cooking. Honest to Pete, I really did. And there were Kurds that were cooking the meal. Remember when we went to the Isle of Kanali? It was marvelous. I would be absolutely delighted if the American government recognized the genocide. It would mean a lot to us first-generation Armenians. I don't think we'll ever see it, but I do really believe that.
I don't know. I don't have to think about forgiveness. Let me say this. I feel a little queasy around Turkish people. Let me say that. If someone is not sorry for what they've done, how can you forgive them?
I'm hoping they're really sincere and admitting it for the future. I have hope that the Turkish government will recognize it. make atonement for what their ancestors did. They didn't do it. It's this generation is not our enemy. I feel a little warmer as I grow older towards a Turk.
I think I've become more religious because of it, whether it's my mother's teachings or whatever. She taught me many, many prayers in Armenian, and till this day, I say them every morning. That's one. Yeah. Oh Lord, open up my lips to show forth thy praise. Diriye teşirtunusiz padats peranusiz yevyerketse zortnutunut kor. But that's what I say every morning when I wash my face. And I had prayers that she taught me before going to bed. I was just a little thing.
We wish to thank WBAI for their commitment to recognizing the Armenian Genocide and are grateful to the following individuals for opening their hearts and sharing the difficult memories of the past. Jenny Garabedian, Harry Mazadorian, Roxy Garabedian, Lucy Simonian, Roxy Maljanian, Mary Abrahamian, John Maljanian, Agnes Karanian, Ruth Swisher, and Artie Shaverdian.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.